Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
If saving more and spending less is one of your top goals for 2023, why are you still paying insane amounts of money every month for your phone bill? Right now, when you switch to Mint Mobile, you'll get their unlimited plan for 50% off. As the first company to sell premium wireless service online only, Mint Mobile lets you order from home and save a ton with phone plans starting at just $15 a month. All plans come with unlimited talk and text, plus high-speed data delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. Cut your wireless bill to 15 bucks a month at mintmobile.com/save. That's mintmobile.com/save. Hurry. Offer ends January 15th.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and at 14 hours GMT on Friday, January the 27th, these are our main stories. Fears of a renewed cycle of violence between Israel and Palestinian militants a day after the bloodiest ever Israeli raid in the occupied West Bank. Shares in one of India's biggest companies have lost 20% of their value after investors were spooked by allegations of financial misconduct. And rebels in the east of the Democratic Republic of Congo have captured a key town in defiance of a recent peace agreement. Also in this podcast, Ukrainians face up to the challenge of a new enemy, corruption, made worse by the war with Russia. Novak Djokovic makes it through to the final of the Australian Open, but his dad's been put on best behaviour. And
he appeared slightly taller than some of them, even the girl next to him who was wearing high heels.
The mystery of the miraculously growing Vladimir Putin, explained. There's been more violence between Israel and Palestinian militants following Thursday's raid in the occupied West Bank, which was itself, according to UN records, the bloodiest ever such incident. At least 9 Palestinians were killed at a camp in Jenin during what the Israelis described as a counter-terrorism operation against Islamic Jihad. The militant group vowed revenge, and just after midnight on Friday, rockets were fired towards southern Israel from the Palestinian territory of Gaza. Neither Islamic Jihad nor another Palestinian militant group, Hamas, which rules Gaza, said it fired the rockets, which were intercepted by Israel's Iron Dome missile defense system. It wasn't long before Israeli fighter jets were scrambled. Israel said its target in Gaza was an underground rocket factory operated by Hamas. As yet, there have been no reports of casualties. Large rallies were expected to take place in Gaza on Friday as worshippers poured out of mosques after prayers on the Muslim holy day. Our Middle East correspondent Tom Bateman told me that the fear now is that the area could find itself plunged into another deadly cycle of violence.
Well, you mentioned Gaza, first of all, and we have seen very, very big crowds in most of the cities of Gaza, in Gaza City, in Rafah in the south, and in some of the refugee camps. So very large crowds. But within the Gaza Strip itself, we're not talking about things that get near to the perimeter fence with Israel. But yes, very large crowds. Some of the rallies organized by Hamas, by Palestinian Islamic Jihad militant groups that are in control in Gaza. We also saw a very big rally actually after lunchtime prayers outside the Dome of the Rock and Al-Aqsa Mosque compound here in Jerusalem. So a lot of solidarity among Palestinians for what happened in Jenin yesterday. And all of that follows, as you say, an exchange of fire between militants in Gaza and Israel overnight. At least 2 rockets fired from Gaza towards Israel, and then airstrikes on a Hamas facility inside the Gaza Strip during the night. That incident, that exchange, I think appears to be over for now. But of course, tensions remain extremely high.
3 children and a 61-year-old woman were among those killed in the Israeli raid yesterday that sparked the latest violence. We've been hearing from a local doctor who witnessed the violence in Jenin. He decided to stop and try to help those injured. Here's his testimony.
So my name is Adham Darame. I'm a Palestinian physician. You could smell the tear gas everywhere you go. You could hear the screaming. You could hear the bombs, the bullets. When I was getting to Jenin, we could see the smoke rising from the city, from the refugee camp. So I had to go to see if I could help. There was an Israeli sniper. Everyone trying to cross the street, he was getting shot. You could see the bullets hitting the ground. So we continued. We managed to cross the street. But once we got about 200 meters from the governmental hospital of Jenin, which is at the entrance, almost at the entrance of the refugee camp, we could not go forward because there was a bulldozer, an Israeli bulldozer, blocking the street. Then the Israeli, suddenly, when I was there, I saw this was with my own eyes. The Israelis started to hit the gas tear bombs inside the hospital. Suddenly, shots were rising, bullets, you could hear bullets everywhere, bombs were heard everywhere. And from inside the hospital, you could hear the screaming because some of the tear gas bombs were inside the department for children, for little children. I saw one of the guys getting shocked in his back, in the lower back, in the left side. And he had to be carried right away to the hospital, but we couldn't because there was an Israeli sniper. The sniper was shooting, so we had to wait. Like, we put something on him and press on the wound until the ambulance came. Even the ambulance was hit with various bullets.
So, was Israel's operation in Jenin justifiable in any way? Michelle Kotler-Wunsch is a former member of the Israeli parliament for the Liberal Blue and White Party.
So when you zero in on the events of yesterday, you have to ensure that you explain that Jenin is actually a hotbed of genocidal terror. And the organization that took responsibility for including for those some of those that were killed yesterday is the Islamic Jihad. Islamic Jihad targets the annihilation of the State of Israel and its civilians systematically, and Jenin actually has become, as I said, over decades, the hotbed of exporting that genocidal terror, very sadly holding its own residents as human shields. And what happened yesterday was indeed the Israel Defense Forces doing its duty as any army would to protect Israel's civilians from a ticking time bomb attack that was scheduled to take place on Israeli civilians that do not differentiate, by the way, between Jews and Arabs or Christians.
Israeli politician Michelle Kotler-Wunsch. Perhaps sympathy for the world's seventh richest man should be limited. But this time yesterday, Gautam Adani was the world's fourth richest man. In the past couple of days, the value of the companies he runs has fallen by $48 billion. The Adani Group is an economic powerhouse in India with access to the highest levels of government. But it's been badly wounded by a hostile report from a United States firm, making allegations which Adani denies. To explain just what's going on and why, here's our South Asia regional editor, Anbarasan Etarajan.
Well, there was panic selling, creating, tremors in the Indian financial circles in the last few days because Hindenburg Research, a U.S. investment firm, they came out with a report a few days ago accusing the Adani Group of accounting fraud, stock manipulation and the use of offshore tax havens, among other things. That has sent shockwaves because this is one of the, high-profile companies in India with the owner or the man who controls it. Gautam Adani is worth about nearly $100 billion, one of the richest in the world. And that has started, people started selling shares following this report. But then the company has dismissed these allegations, saying malicious. But they also point out that this is this Hindenburg Research is they specialize in short selling, which means they bet against a share price of certain companies, expecting that to fall. And they have some investments in Adani shares as well. So there is some conflict of interest. There is some vested interest, according to some critics. But what it has done is, people were worried because they've invested money. I mean, the $48 billion of value going in a few days, it is an extraordinary event for even a seasoned watcher of Indian financial market. And that has really caused concerns, not only for the investors and also for the banks and others who have loaned money to this company.
Yeah. Is there any truth, though, in these allegations that are made by this company, or how are we going to find out?
Well, after the Adani Group threatened that they're going to pursue legal action against Hindenburg Research and that company, the investment firm from New York, they came out with a response saying that they welcome that. They would go for a legal action. They would welcome that because then many things will come out if they can produce all the documents. But what's happening with the Adani Group is that in the last 30 years, Mr. Adani himself has seen as someone close to the Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi. And many opposition parties have accused Mr. Adani of getting favorable policy treatment from the administration of Mr. Modi when he was the Chief Minister of Gujarat, both of them from the state of Gujarat, Mr. Adani and Mr. Modi. And even when he was the Chief Minister, when Modi was the Chief Minister, there were accusations that he was getting favorable treatment. And later on, when Modi became the Prime Minister, then he expanded into many areas of controlling ports, the airports, renewable energy, and many industries. Suddenly he became India's richest man, a big conglomerate. So these are raising accusations, and that's why India's main opposition Congress party, they are calling for a thorough and credible investigation by the regulators, because this is going to affect not only banks, but also people who have saved their money, put their money into the banks.
Anbarasan Etarajan. An asteroid the size of a minibus has made one of the closest approaches to Earth ever recorded, passing just over 3,500 kilometres from the surface of our planet. That's much closer than many satellites. Andrew Lound, who's an author and space commentator, told us more about asteroid 2023 BU.
It was only spotted last Saturday, so not very long ago. And it's probably a piece of a major asteroid. I mean, it's only a fragment which got blasted off maybe many millions of years ago and has continually orbited the sun. And every so often it crosses the Earth's path. And it's probably passed the Earth numerous times already, but we just happened to spot it for the very first time. But it wasn't going to enter the Earth's atmosphere this time. It was going to whiz around the Earth and then zoom up and have its orbit changed slightly by the Earth's gravity, but it'll still maintain orbiting the sun, and it will likely encounter us again at some point. But fortunately, it's of a size where it would be likely to burn up in the atmosphere rather than cause any damage if it did come through the atmosphere.
OK, so how big or how close do asteroids need to be in order to start causing us problems, either to satellites in space or to us here on the Earth's surface?
Well, even a small grain of sand could damage a satellite because of the velocities they're moving at. So something about 25 metres across. And that kind of event happens usually once every 100 years. And that's what you call an airburst. And that's the type of event that happened in 1908, which destroyed a forest in Siberia, the famous Tunguska event. And they usually happen every 100, 150 years or so, although there is a report there may have been one over the Amazon in 1970 of that. And then things which are a lot bigger, four or five times the size of that, happen every 20,000 years, and they can cause quite a large crater on the ground and then cause big damage. And of course, as we all know, once in every 100 million years or so, you get one which will hit the Earth and will cause mass extinctions on the planet. Bearing in mind the asteroid that hit the Earth 66 million years ago, which caused the extinction of the dinosaurs, that actually led to the rise of mammals, which is us. So we actually owe our life to such an event, an extinction event, and we're the first species that probably can stop it happening again.
Andrew Lound speaking to Victoria Valentine. The director of the museum at the former Nazi death camp of Auschwitz-Birkenau has used commemorations for Holocaust Remembrance Day to denounce Russia's war in Ukraine. Speaking to an audience that included Holocaust survivors, Piotr Savinsky likened the mindset that led to the horrors of the Holocaust and other Nazi crimes to that of the current Russian leadership. Dr. Savinsky warned of the dangers of staying silent and equated some of the place names associated with infamous Nazi crimes with sites of Russian atrocities in Ukraine.
Warszawska Wola, Zamojszczyzna, Oradour.
The Warsaw district of Wola, Zamojszczyzna, Oradour and Lidice. Now there are different names. Bucha, Irpin, Hostomel, Mariupol, Donetsk. Similar sick megalomania, similar lust for power, and almost same-sounding myths of exceptionalism, of greatness, of primacy, but written in Russian.
For the first time, no Russian officials have been invited to the Auschwitz commemorations, even though the camp was liberated by Soviet troops. In Ukraine itself, people have been digesting new allegations of corruption levelled against some government ministers. President Zelensky has sacked a number of top officials. But many Ukrainians now say they have another enemy in addition to the Russians. Corruption, often made worse by the war. James Waterhouse reports from Kyiv.
Ever since Ukraine broke free from the Soviet Union, Russia has tried to pull it back. Its 31 years of independence has also seen the country grapple with a foe closer to home. Corruption. Tackling it was one of President Zelensky's big election promises in 2019.
My election has proved that citizens are tired of experienced politicians who over the past 28 years created a country of opportunities. Opportunities to steal, bribe and loot.
This week, he's overseen around a dozen resignations or sackings across national and regional governments. The timing is bad and the allegations are serious. They include a deputy minister accepting a bribe of hundreds of thousands of pounds, a department paying inflated prices, as well as a company belonging to a senior official's personal trainer receiving millions of pounds since the full-scale invasion. Plus, a story about President Zelensky's deputy head of office. Kirill Tymoshenko quit 2 months after reports he'd moved his family to the mansion of a well-known property developer and spent a few months driving an expensive new Porsche. How these stories came out is largely down to one person. 5 flights of stairs later, and we're at the offices of a new site called Ukrainska Pravda. It means Ukrainian truth. And we're going to meet an investigative journalist called Mikhailo Tkach.
If the source of the money is unclear, they register things, such as cars or mansions, to those close to them. But I think every step an official takes should be clear to all. The president's latest decision also shows that such responsibility is recognized at the highest level. We are talking about the country's future. It is very important.
A walk through Irpin reminds you of just how much this war has taken from people. Here, a burnt-out shell of what once was a residential block sits next to 2 cars in the car park, riddled with rusty bullet holes from Russia's advance last spring. Where there is fighting in some parts of Ukraine, there are signs of recovery in others. People are focusing on their immediate problems. So when there are claims of corruption once again at the heart of Ukrainian politics, what effect does that have?
In the small town of Vorsel, near Kyiv, there's a window in between power cuts. Despite this, Ivana is less than impressed. As her husband stirs dough in the back room of her bakery, her corruption fatigue is hard to hide.
I don't like it. It would be better if this money went for something good for Ukraine rather than to someone's pocket. Probably we need to replace all those who are there for many years. They got used to that.
It's here on Kyiv's Independence Square 9 years ago that there was a popular revolution. People protested against the lack of democracy they lived under. In 2023, Ukraine is fighting a similar battle, but in a different way, against a backdrop of Russia's continued invasion of Ukraine.
In Kyiv, James Waterhouse. Still to come, our very last news from elsewhere. And
I was the typical ovarian cancer patient that presented in A&E. And this study has been shown to be able to change that so we can get the diagnosis earlier, which makes a huge difference.
How shopping lists could help flag up possible cancer before it's too late. Rebels from the notorious M23 movement in the Democratic Republic of Congo have taken control of a key town in the east after days of intensive clashes that have displaced nearly 500,000 people. The United Nations has condemned the raid. For more, I spoke to the BBC's Ferdinand Amondi in Nairobi.
In the last few days, there has been intensive fighting, particularly after M23 claimed that there were attempts to conduct another genocide on the Tutsi, who are the main community residents in that area. So the rebels now captured this strategic town of Kichanga. It is under their command, and indeed the United Nations has called on the M23 to lay down their arms and move out of the areas it has occupied as part of the agreement that was signed last year in Angola.
Why is it being called a strategic town?
So Kichanga is a town that lies between mainland DRC and the Rwanda border, and is also very close to the city of Goma, which is the capital of North Kivu province in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Goma, as you may know, is the economic and political hub of this mineral-rich region, and it has a significant population of internally displaced persons running away from the conflicts, and is also the base for the UN peacekeeping missions in the area and the Congolese army. So Kichanga, in this sense, is considered an important pathway for people, goods, services, and even arms. And so both the army and the rebels have always fought to control it. And so by controlling Kichanga, the M23 will see that now they have controlled the main place and can be able to cut off the militants who they say are pursuing their people, and can also be a base from where they can protect the Tutsi community as they claim they are doing.
The M23 rebels signed up to a ceasefire agreement last year. Why has this been broken now?
There have been lots of accusations and counter-accusations since that agreement was signed. This ceasefire agreement, first of all, was aimed at getting M23 to withdraw from all earlier areas it is occupying and end its attacks. And although they did not attend the Luanda Accord itself, they agreed to abide by it. This agreement provides for the deployment of the East African Regional Force, which has been done. However, there have been accusations and counter-accusations. The government, particularly President Felix Tshisekedi, said last week that M23 are not really withdrawing from the areas it's occupying, claiming that they were strengthening, and also continually accused Rwanda of continuing its support for those rebels. M23, on the other hand, says that the DRC government has failed or refuses to disarm these rebels, particularly the FDLR, who are mainly composed of the Hutu militants who participated in the Rwanda genocide. Seeing also heightened tension between Rwanda and DRC. Early in the week, a fighter jet belonging to DRC was fired at by Rwanda, claiming that it crossed into its airspace, and Rwanda denied, and they've both called this acts of aggression. So there are now strong concerns that the situation is escalating, and you've seen a senator now calling for an extraordinary meeting of parliament to try and discuss the way forward for the Democratic Republic of Congo.
The BBC's Ferdinand Amondi. The military regime in Myanmar has ordered political parties to re-register under its electoral laws. Observers say the move is the latest indication that an election is imminent. Celia Hatton reports.
The new rules ensure Myanmar's military authorities will face little meaningful competition in an election. National parties must pledge to mobilize at least 100,000 members within 90 days of registration. The rules also imply that the party that was ousted in the coup, the National League for Democracy, will be banned outright. Myanmar's former leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, is in prison, and many other NLD members are also behind bars or in exile, leaving only a small number of regional parties left to run against the military.
Celia Hatton. Novak Djokovic has won a place in the Australian Open tennis final with a straight sets win against the American Tommy Paul. Off court, though, things haven't been going quite as smoothly. His father, Serjan Djokovic, has issued a response after being photographed posing with supporters of Russia's President Putin following his son's match on Wednesday. Our tennis correspondent Russell Fuller is in Melbourne for the tournament and told me more.
Yesterday he was photographed posing for photographs with Vladimir Putin supporters. One man who he took a photo with was holding a flag of Russia with Vladimir Putin's face on it. This man was also wearing a T-shirt with the pro-war Z symbol on it. And as a result of that happening, Tennis Australia, the organisers of this first Grand Slam of the year, said that they had reminded players and their teams of their obligation to avoid incidents like this that could potentially cause disruption. Well, there had been no statement from Novak or Sergej Djokovic over the past 24 hours. But a little earlier, Novak Djokovic's team released a statement on behalf of his father, which said, well, the inference is that he got unwittingly caught up in a group of pro-Putin supporters. He said, I'm here to support my son only. I had no intention of causing such headlines or disruption. I was outside with Novak's fans, as I have done after all of my son's matches, to celebrate his wins and take pictures with them.
Is that a credible explanation given the photographs? It certainly looks as though it would be hard to miss what was going on behind him or next to him.
Well, he's certainly a man who would like to mix with his son's fans potentially after a win. And as he's explained there, it's something he will do from time to time. I think it's one of those where people will draw their own conclusions. Unfortunately, Novak Djokovic has become a very divisive figure over the last few years, particularly here in Melbourne, given what happened last year when he was deported from the country on the eve of the Australian Open after a deportation hearing, ultimately relating to his stance on the COVID vaccine. And since he's been here, there have been times where he has spoken quite firmly to officials in the chair who he felt were not cracking down on people targeting him unfairly during matches. But generally, he's been on a little bit of a charm offensive. He has been very well received, not just here in Melbourne, but in Adelaide as well, where he played and won a warm-up tournament before the Australian Open.
Our tennis correspondent, Russell Fuller, courtside in Melbourne. Doctors in Britain say shopping habits could give an early indication that you may be at risk of particular types of cancer. They found that the frequent purchase of over-the-counter indigestion remedies and painkillers are a possible early warning alert for women that may have ovarian cancer, a disease that is often diagnosed tragically late. Fiona Murphy, who helped to develop the study, was diagnosed with ovarian cancer in 2008 after experiencing symptoms for almost 2 years. She says the findings have huge potential.
To get an earlier diagnosis for ovarian cancer is really crucial because at the moment it's usually stage 3 or stage 4. And I was the typical ovarian cancer patient that presented in A&E. And this study has been shown to be able to change that. So before it gets to that progressive stage, we can get the diagnosis earlier, which makes a huge difference to patients' outcomes.
Dr. James Flanagan led the research.
The symptoms for ovarian cancer are generally considered quite vague. Most women might not even recognise them as ovarian cancer symptoms. Things like stomach pain or feeling bloated, feeling full quickly, weeing more often. These are all things that you might not consider as cancer symptoms. And it's probably not surprising that people would treat them with over-the-counter medications before they start thinking, hang on, this is persisting a little bit longer and perhaps I should go to my GP. Our study was a case control study, so we were comparing women with ovarian cancer to women without. So we weren't considering any other possible reasons why someone might be buying these medications. And so the important thing is, if you're experiencing the symptoms, go and talk to your GP, and hopefully your GP can help sort out whether there's alarming symptoms or it's symptoms of something more common. Patients get diagnosed through various things. The scan is part of that. There's also a blood test, a CA125 test, and there's also, I guess, the discussion with GPs or with the cancer clinics about all the other potential symptoms.
Researcher Dr. James Flanagan. It's time now for our weekly News from Elsewhere spot, where we talk about some of the less reported stories from around the world. Joining me is Alastair Coleman from BBC Monitoring, which follows foreign media in many languages. First, Alastair, the country where you're going to be paid to cycle to work.
Yes, that country is Belgium, where people who cycle to work are to get an allowance for doing so, national broadcaster VRT says. If you're not part of an existing scheme with your workplace, and that's been a thing in Belgium for some time now, thanks to a deal between trade unions and employers organisations, you can claim 27 euro cents per kilometre of your commute per day, up to a maximum of 40 kilometres. It's designed to encourage more people to get out of their cars with all the health, road traffic and environmental benefits that come with regular cycling. It also means the payment is a universal benefit for anybody who wants it.
On to Singapore, where people there are defying the authorities over vaping.
Vaping, yes. The use of so-called electronic cigarettes is banned in Singapore, but more and more people are still willing to take the risk, it appears. 5,000 were caught and fined up to 2,000 Singapore dollars last year in the city-state, which, among other things, is famous for banning chewing gum. And you don't have to look hard to find someone who will sell you vape equipment and liquids, the Straits Times reports. But as the ban reaches its fifth anniversary next month, there's a thriving online industry selling mail-order vape gear, often described as incense burners or health products to avoid detection by the authorities. There's also a lucrative smuggling sector. Last month, some 30,000 vape products were seized from a lorry crossing the border, disguised as chicken nuggets. As one customs official put it, "Winner, winner, chicken dinner."
It's almost poetry. And finally, the Ukraine conflict and a small victory for Kyiv in the information war. What's happening?
Well, for the past month, TV viewers in Crimea, the Ukrainian territory which has been occupied by Russia since 2014, expecting to see Russia's main TV news programme, are instead seeing speeches by Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. And it's all down to the authorities in Kyiv hacking into the Russian satellite TV signals, feeding state television to Crimea. Now, technical experts at BBC Monitoring have been watching with interest as Kyiv broadcasts its own strongest signal to the satellite, which fools terrestrial transmitters which rely on the satellite signal from Moscow into broadcasting the Ukrainian signals instead. And now it's spread. It's happening in Russia's Belgorod, the region bordering eastern Ukraine. And it seems there's very little Russia can do about it. In fact, they've moved from a satellite over the Atlantic to ones over India. But the Ukrainian hack has just followed them there.
Fascinating. Alistair, thank you so much. And Alistair, this is our last news from elsewhere for the moment. So I just wanted to say thank you so much for everything you've done for us over recent months. We've enjoyed it a lot.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Now, the Russian President Vladimir Putin has plenty on his mind with the country still embroiled in the war, or special operation, as he prefers to call it, in Ukraine. But he's received an unlikely boost from, of all things, a pair of shoes. Richard Hamilton told me more.
So on the 25th of January, which is Russia's National Student Day, known as Tatiana Day, he was photographed at the Lomonosov Moscow State University, surrounded by smiling students. But he appeared slightly taller than some of them, even the girl next to him who was wearing high heels. And this seems to be because he, Mr. Putin, was actually wearing high heels, or at least built up soles. And this has led to sort of comments and jokes and smirks on social media. And there's a close screen grabs of close up where they zoom in. You can see that they're slightly thick heels. And now he's 5'7", which is 170 centimetres tall. And in the past, psychologists have suggested things like he's got a Napoleon complex. A British MP, shortly after the invasion, Julian Lewis, he told Parliament that Mr. Putin was firmly in the grip of small man syndrome. And a Ukrainian oligarch also described him as a schizophrenic of short stature.
Yeah, he's always been very careful about his public image, hasn't he?
Exactly, yeah. And reportedly, bodyguards are chosen who are of shorter stature than him. He's very careful about how he's photographed. And a lot of the time in rather macho settings and poses, so on a judo mat, on the ice hockey rink, fishing, hunting, often topless, next to dead tigers, polar bears, cuddling a Bulgarian sheepdog. And even oddly, this is one of the most weird ones, standing in a wetsuit, having appeared from the Black Sea, mysteriously having discovered some rare Greek amphorae.
Dobby the house elf?
Oh, yes. Well, very quickly, there was a Russian lawsuit that they said that he looked remarkably similar to the Harry Potter character.
Richard Hamilton, who is incidentally 6'2" or 1.88 metres, and that's without high heels. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter @GlobalNewsPod. This edition was mixed by Mike Adley, and the producer was Mark Duff. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.